And when I had a closer look at it in the recent past, I find that from the experimental point of view, from whatever we know about psilocin from experiments, as well as from theory point of view, I think it's going to be another wonderful material, somewhat different from graphene in a very fundamental way. So people have called graphene as a magic carpet. So this is another magic carpet, I believe. So at the moment, the carpet is empty. So you're welcome to take a ride. Okay. So over years, I have collaborated with these colleagues and worked on graphene, and that gave me some confidence to think about this new material. So I have stuck my neck out and put a paper in the archive with a provocative title, Room Temperature Superconductivity, Spin Liquid and Mott Insulator, Silicin and Germanine as Prospective Playgrounds. So this is what I will be doing today. So I will spend some time thinking, talking about graphene, and then talk about some little bit of quantum chemistry and point out how silicin and germanine are different in some detail. And we will see that based on experimental and theoretical arguments that it's likely to be a Mott insulator with very large parameters, which we all love from the point of view of high temperature superconductivity and spin liquids. Then I will discuss close with this remark about superconductivity. So the last 20, 30 years, we have gone into electronic systems where electron correlations play a fundamental role. If you take classical electronic system like copper or semiconductors, the elementary excitations are electron-like. So the electrons are excitations, or electron has not lost its identity. They behave as electrons in terms of excitations. But when you have strong correlations, many unexpected things happen. There are emergent phenomena and very novel excitations. There are collective behavior, totally unrelated to the behavior of a single electron. So that is what we saw in the context of cuprates, where we had a Mott insulator. When doped, it became a very high temperature superconductor with scales completely unanticipated. Then following the discovery of cuprates, there has been several new discoveries. So while trying to put them all together and particularly enthuse experimental colleagues about making new materials, I wrote this article a few years ago, Fivefold Weight New Superconductors, where cuprate is the beginning. Then there are family of organic materials where you start with the Mott insulator and you apply pressure, you get superconductivity now as large as 13 Kelvin in some of these organic salts, and then as large as about 40 Kelvin in these fullerites. So it's amazing when you look at the carrier density, they are very small. In spite of that, they manage to become high temperature superconductors. So that's the pressure route. Again, electron correlation plays a very important role. This is something that many people are not familiar with. Diamond is very expensive and very nice, and you can make it look dark and dirty by replacing some of the carbon by boron by 1 or 2%. Then it turns out it becomes superconducting. So to me, it's much more exciting than a diamond jewel. My wife won't agree with me, but so, and if you look carefully, it seems to provide a way to create correlated impurity bands, and there is beautiful physics of strongly correlated system and resonating valence bonds and so on. So this offers, sorry?
We have expands here.
Exactly. In diamond, people replaced 2% of carbon by boron, it becomes superconducting with a TC as large as 13 Kelvin. So, if you look at angle resolved photoemission and other properties, it's a very dirty metal, but it manages to become superconducting. So I have developed a theory in terms of impurity band Mott insulator. Then, of course, graphene is a fascinating system, very broad band, but still there is electron correlation at some intermediate level. This has been also one of the routes. then people are very excited about iron arsenide superconductors. At least some of them can be called as double RBB system, where basically there is a spin one Mott insulator which gets self-doped and you get superconductivity. So at least there are about five routes to synthesizing new materials. So today I will focus on this graphene route.
Does that graphene route have an experimental realization? I know, that's theoretical.
Exactly, yeah. So far, the problem is you'll have to dope graphene to
about
10%, and that has not been achieved so far. So far, the theory remains safe. So experiments are yet to be done.
But the other four have an experimental.
Exactly, yeah. This is, in fact, if one goes along this line, it is not necessarily a diamond. You can take any insulator, and if you find an appropriate impurity and create an impurity band, you can have parameters which are good enough to have high temperatures. Exactly. Sand, yeah. Okay, and this, you know, the whole field of organics, this is this iron-based superconductors and copper. So in the periodic table, we have lots of superconductors. Now the question is, can I have a monovalent material, just one component, and can it become a room temperature superconductor? It's a real challenge. So why we call graphene as a wonder material or a magic carpet is, you see simplicity to complexity, which I summarize in this particular graph. This is taken from my article here. So what is remarkable is you have a carbon atom which has this electronic configuration. Now, because the electronic energy level of 2s and 2p is about 10 electron volt different, it tends to have very strong sp2 hybridization. It can also have sp3. For example, when you do sp3 hybridization, you get diamond, which is supposed to have slightly higher energy than real graphite. And if you go to the world of carbon nanotube, things are bent and there is an sp2 and sp3 mixing. So there is a whole world. So let us focus on the graphene world, which is sp2 hybridization. If you, as you know, the quantum chemistry of sp2, it automatically forces you to have, through sigma bonding, three neighbors. So that immediately gives you a honeycomb lattice. And if you look at the valency, you'll have a filled sigma band, and then you have pi band containing one electron per carbon atom. You immediately have this beautiful tight bending honeycomb lattice with pi and pi star bands. And then one consequence is, if you look at the edges, there are flat bands at the edges, non-dispersing bands, and then there is possibility of magnetism. And if you come down, there are Dirac cones at K and K prime point, and the block wave functions have chirality character, so that leads to anti-localization. And then there are things like parity anomaly and spin Hall effect, and including two-channel contour effect, because there are two Dirac cones. And then if you take this structure and deform it or create defects, they behave, because of this peculiar band structure, like a gauge field. You see a very simple consequence of an sp2 hybridization all the way down here. Now if you go this side, because there are Dirac cones and relative stick type things, the so-called possibility of Zitterbogen or Klein tunneling, you know, which looks very esoteric from high energy physics point of view or field theory point of view, but from condensed matter it's fairly straightforward. Similarly, you can create a situation in which you can achieve Lorentz boost, time dilation, Lorentz contraction, vacuum collapse, and so on, all in simple graphene. And then Pauling, many years ago, started his idea of resonating valence bond with benzene and extended it to graphene. So it's a playground for RBB ideas long back. And now there is a proposal that doped graphene could become room temperature superconductor if you sufficiently dope it. Then there are novel spin one collective modes, even possibility of room temperature superconductivity, ferromagnetism, anomalous Landau level spacing, which is experimentally seen, and room temperature quantum Hall states, and a very novel fractional quantum Hall states, and composite Fermi, and so on. So just, you can trace all these things back to this very simple sp2 bonding. So this is what I call as complexity from simplicity. And from our group at MatScience, we have worked on whatever is shadowed here. For example, with Akbar Jafari, we predicted a spin-1 collective mode in graphene arising from moderate interaction. Experimentally, because of some difficulties, it has not been seen. The energy is a little higher than the usual neutron scattering. Then we have talked about two-channel contour effect with Krishnendu Sengupta. And this is something that, which is very interesting, that you take graphene and apply cross the electric and magnetic field, and then you can do a Lorentz boost and then see experimentally, in principle, time dilation and Lorentz contraction. And part of it has been seen, actually. And then composite Fermi-C and spin one collective mode. So there are very interesting possibilities in graphene. So this is the basics of graphene. You all know that you have a honeycomb net. There are two sublattices, and there are four valence electrons. And three of the electrons get swallowed up by this sigma bond, and you have this red pz orbital, which are perpendicular to this plane, and there is one electron in each orbital. So it's a very simple, beautiful tight binding system, and you can write down real space lattice and the k space. I will not go into the detail, you are all familiar with this. Long back, Wallace from Canada worked out a tight binding model, and this is what he got. He got a valence band and conduction band touching each other at what we call as a Dirac cone. So basically, because there are two atoms per unit cell in a honeycomb lattice, there is a hole-like band, and then there is an electron-like band. They both touch at K and K prime point. Like this is the way if you walk, get this band structure. And all interesting physics takes place because the density of states vanishes at the Fermi level here, and the wave functions have chirality character, and so on. So if you look at the dispersion close to this Dirac cone, it is described by this, with a Fermi velocity which is very large, 10 raised to 6 meters per second. It's not velocity of light, but a few hundred times lower than that, but still it's very remarkable. Now, making use of this similarity to Dirac theory, Semenoff, Gordon Semenoff, actually wrote a beautiful paper back in 1983, and Duncan Haldane immediately pointed out that you could imagine some of the anomalies, that parity anomaly that Semenoff was looking for, by having some proper magnetic fluxes and so on. I will not go into the detail. Now, recently, in the context of graphene, it has got a rebirth through Kane and Mele. They talk about spin orbit, spin Hall effect through the weak spin orbit coupling. That in turn led to this topological insulators and so on. So this is part of active study. Now, if you look at periodic table, and often we don't look at this periodic table from this point of view, this just gives you the size of the atomic radii. Now, if you look at the extreme, the left, so-called alkali metals, the whole life process and biology depends on this small difference in ionic radii between sodium and potassium. Because if you look at electrophysiological activity, nerve conduction, and so on, basically, you are pushing against some potential gradient, some potassium, and then it is this potential difference which propagates as nerve impulses. And for all kinds of biological activities, it's important. Similarly, there are places in which calcium plays a very important role. And if you look at the underlying biochemistry, the atomic radius becomes very important. So this is something that we don't realize. So today I'm going to argue that that's why it's going to happen. When you look at this column, already we know that carbon creates diamond, which has a very wide gap insulator. And then silicon has a smaller gap. Germanium has even smaller gap. When you come to tin and lead, they are metals. So the ionic radius, which is progressively increasing, plays one important role. And there are, of course, other considerations. So today we will see that this ionic radius difference, when you go from carbon to atomic radius, carbon to silicon, that's going to make very important difference. So silicene and germanium are graphene analogs, with carbon being replaced by silicon or germanium. Now, previously we had nice sp2 bonding. Now there will be a small sp3 admixture. I will explain that in detail. If you look at the atomic radius and the bond length, you find it's really 60% larger. So that's, for quantum chemists, that's a large difference. So the bond length in graphene is 1.4 angstrom unit. In silicon, it's about 2.3 angstrom unit. So the lattice is dilated. So we are going to argue that it has profound consequences. For example, if you look at silicon, which is exactly bonded like in graphene, there is one fundamental difference. There are two fundamental differences. One is the lattice parameters increased, and another is what is called puckering. That is, you notice that sublattice A, which are red atoms, have come out of the blackboard, and blue has gone into the blackboard. So there is a small C-axis display, relative displacement of atoms between A and B sublattices by about 0.7 or 0.6 angstrom minute. If you look sideways, this is what it looks like. So this is basically due to the fact that when you go from carbon to silicon, the 2s, the 3s and 3p energy difference is now reduced to 5 electron volt as opposed to 10 electron volt. So this system can easily admix or lead to some sp3 admixing. And as you know, pure sp3 will lead to tetrahedral bonding, and sp2 will lead to just this bonding in the plane with three neighbors. So an admixture will mean that you can rise from your place vertically upwards and downwards. So it's as simple as that. Now, what are the consequences? Chemists worried about it long back. Now, this is a well-known DR system. We learn it in schools, benzene, C6H6. So since silicon is below carbon in the periodic table, is it possible to make Si6H6? So it's called the hexasilabenzene. When a name is something so complicated, I'm sure it'll be very difficult to make it. So far they have not made it. So the reason is, in fact, many chemists worried about it. They said that if you look at the stability of benzene, it comes from a very strong covalent bond between the pz electron between neighboring atoms, and also the so-called resonance. So the resonating valence bond that we talk about. So that leads to lot of cohesive energy and stabilization. Whereas when you do the same thing for silicon, it's considerably reduced. So chemists say that there is no aromaticity. There is reduced aromaticity and radicalization. Radicalization means the electron doesn't form a strong with the neighbor, so its spins are relatively free. So it does form some singlet, but the singlets are weaker. So this is in fact a subfield in the field of organic chemistry. People trying to synthesize this compound and failing. And last year there was a science paper in which they synthesized this compound, except that one of the hydrogen is replaced by some side group. So that is considered as a great success in chemistry community. So this is the story about trying to form planar system with silicon. So, okay. Now this is also something very important. Radicalization in chemistry means, for example, creating some free spinning. All of you know that if you take oxygen molecule, it has even number of electrons. But however, the ground state is not a singlet, it's a spin one state. So it has very profound consequences, including in biology. And nitric oxide has an unpaired spin, and then polyaniline and so on. So there is a close similarity between free electron formation, that is unpaired electron formation or a dangling bond formation, and MOT localization in solid. I will not go into the detail, but just except to point that out. So once people started talking about silicene, condensed matter band theory, colleagues jumped into it without bothering about what the chemists are saying. They said that it will be stable and you can prepare it. So fortunately, experimentalists listened to them rather than to chemists. And they did manage to create silicene. Because if you talk to the chemistry community, they will say that even hexasilabenzene cannot be prepared, so silicon cannot be prepared. But physicists jumped into it and then managed to prepare silicon on metallic substrates like silver, iridium, and zirconium diborate. So essentially, what happens is metallic substrate does some help in stabilizing an otherwise unstable silicon, which is unstable according to quantum chemists. So this has been synthesized. And let's look at the band structure. For example, if you look at the band structure of silicene and compare it with graphene, please look at this. This is a famous linearly vanishing density of states, or a Dirac cone. You have a similar thing here. The fundamental difference is the scale. If you look at the pi and pi star band of graphene, it disperses over about 18 electron volt. Whereas if you look at silicene, it only disperses over about 5 to 6 electron volt. So just because of a 60% band expansion, the band, the conduction band and valence band has narrowed by a factor of 3. This is something very, very remarkable. We know that whenever band narrowing takes place, electron correlation should play an important role. And that will be the point of view that I will take. So even though qualitatively they look alike, but this is what actually worried chemists. Chemists in the context of hexosilyl benzene, they said that the hopping matrix element or the covalent bond energy is reduced by a factor of 3. So they said it will be unstable. Whereas in the context of solid, the same thing happens, and people have gone ahead and made detailed band structure calculation and also done some experiments. So let me look at some of the experiments and see what is experiment. This is a very famous paper which became very well cited in about 6 months because they saw Dirac cone on silicene. Now, there is at least about 10 papers challenging these cells because apparently when you put silicene on silver, there is a very strong hybridization, and what you see is not a silicene band, it is some hybridized band, strongly hybridized, but there are good evidences for that. So it is very clear now that there is no Dirac cone, and which is substantiated, according to me, by the result that came very soon. Here is silicene grown on zirconium diborate. And if you look at zirconium diborate, it's a refractory metal, a low carrier density metal. So it turns out, even if you look at the band structure and the electron structure calculation, the hybridization between zirconium diborate band and silicene band is low. So in view of that, what you find is a band structure as seen by photoemission, which is remarkably different from the what you expect based on a band theory. If you look at the band theory, you will find a band with a Dirac cone at the K point, which disperses over 3 electron volt. Here you basically something that is dispersing over only about 3/4 of an electron volt. And then there are some other structures. So when I saw this result, I was convinced that actually what we are looking at is a Mott insulator, because if you take lanthanum copper oxide, the Mott insulator parent compound, and look at angle resolved photoemission, that is, you remove a hole by by sending a photon, you find extremely narrow bands at the Fermi level, coming basically from a doped hole in a Mott insulator. The bandwidth will be typically of the order of few J, where J is the exchange constant, and that's what you see. So this is what prompted me to think along this line. That what then I will give theoretical reasons also.
Is there any ordering in these?
Yes, I will come to it. Yeah, potential orders and so. And there is another remarkable result from a group of Kei Hu Wu from I think Beijing, and so they do STM, very careful measurement. What they find is a tunneling characteristic like this, which they say that cannot be explained for whatever experiment they are doing based on charge density wave formation or some other symmetry broken gap structure. I will not go into the detail. So above about 40 Kelvin, you have this structure, and below 40 Kelvin, you have this. So they claim it is superconductivity. And that, then the remarkable thing is, if you look at the 2 delta by KT ratio, it's about 20. Normally, you expect around 3 to 4. This is too large. So this cannot be explained by simple electron photon coupling or any known ordering coming from some Fermi surface nesting, because there are no nesting at the carrier concentration that they have in this system. So this is one experimental observation. Very striking.
Just about the previous slide. What about the spin-orbit interaction?
Yes, a very important point. So because silicon is heavy, there is appreciable spin-orbit interaction. But still, the scale that I'm talking about in terms of electron correlation, it's very small. So it should be taken into account once you have superconductivity and corrections to that. So at the moment, in building a model for silicene, I am ignoring spin-orbit coupling. In fact, there are lots of papers written about consequences of system-orbit coupling in this band picture. And it turns out they have, it's unlike graphene, it's much stronger.
But so what is the magnitude
approximately? It's about 0.5 electron volt. It's quite large, actually, substantial. It has been estimated and
actually,
yeah.
So basically, this sort of gap for the zirconium whatever substrate, or only for the silver one?
Sorry.
The experiment in the next slide is only for the silver substrate.
It's only for the silver substrate. Yeah.
Do they see a similar thing for the other substrate? The one.
They have not done any experiment. So it's interesting that only 5 experiments have been done so far on this system. Some French group. And some Chinese group, and another one, European, some other group. So there are very few experiments.
Isn't there an issue with hybridization you mentioned with the silver?
Okay, so I will come to this when I come to, why in spite of hybridization you have this feature? I will come to it. So then people have taken this silicene on zirconium diboride and added potassium. Then you find features which I will not go into the detail, which is unlike standard band shifting. That is, if you have a standard metal or a standard band insulator or semiconductor, when you add carriers, there is some rigid band shift. Here, if you look at it carefully, new pockets, like in the case of cuprate, where you have pockets in unexpected places, there are new pockets that are formed here. So this is another evidence that something else is going on rather than very simple Dirac cone behavior. This is another important thing. If you take graphene at this magnetic field and apply magnetic field, and if you look at the conductance through STM, you see the absence of field, this V-shaped curve, characteristic of density of states, and then you see lambda level splitting. For the same magnetic field, you don't see anything in silicene. So there is this is coming from Japanese group, very recent work. Now, if you look at the energy level separation between lambda levels and then lifetime broadening, as you can infer from the photo emission, the broadening is larger than this. So that naturally explains that quasi-particles are not that coherent like in graphene. They are strongly scattered. Maybe they have undergone spin charge decoupling or something else. So that, in a very simple way, explains why silicene behaves very differently from this graphene. Then there is another very important thing. In the case of graphene, you put it on any substrate, it remains essentially flat. Whereas what you find is an enormous number of what is called reconstruction. For example, graphene will be like this, in which it will be flat. Now, an idealized silicene will contain A sublattice atoms which are moved up, and B sublattice atoms which are moved down by a small amount, about half an angstrom. Whereas what you find is part of the atoms in some situations which have moved up, not all of them. So this is, there is a periodicity which is called square root of 3 by square root of 3, and there is a 4 by 4. So this reconstruction is ubiquitous in silicene. This is already telling that the electronic cohesion in silicene is much less compared to graphene, which is very strong. So a substrate or any other perturbation is not able to bend those, move these atoms up and down and induce sp3 hybridization. So this is already indicating that the electronic coherence is of Mott insulated type. I will not go into the quantitative details. Okay. Now let me talk about Mott's argument. So the way I am going to view silicene as an expanded graphene. In fact, this is how Mott motivated many years ago. He said that suppose you take a collection of hydrogen atoms with a lattice parameter which is close to Bohr radius. There is a good screening and there is overlap of wave function, you get a half-filled band of metal. Then Mott argued that suppose I expand this lattice and take the lattice parameter to larger values, he argued that there will be localization because the electrons would like to form block states and gain kinetic energy, the process, it has to go away from the parent site. So it has to pluck itself away from the parent site. So there is a strong Coulomb attraction to the protons. And also it has to meet the neighbors. So the repulsion between electrons are high compared to the band energy that you gain. So electrons would rather sit at home than delocalize. So this is a very simple Mott insulator. This is the old picture of Mott. And Mott argued it in a very beautiful way along this line. So he said that, let's start with an electron, which metallic state, and then adiabatically expand the lattice. Then I can ask the question, when will an electron form a quantum mechanical bound state with the hole that it left behind at its home site? So any electron is finally has come from some home site. So you can ask the question that suppose I have an empty site and I have an electron, there will be an attraction between them. And of course, other electrons will run around and do screening. So as I dilate the lattice, screening will become less and less important. So Mott argued that at a stage, a bound state will be formed. So when a bound state is formed, some free electrons will disappear. This will reduce screening further and increase the binding energy. So more electrons will disappear. So there is a feedback leading to a first order phase transition. This is a beautiful argument due to Mott. So he basically did a very simple hydrogenic type of calculation by calculating Thomas Fermi screening length for a given density of electron and put it into the bound state calculation. You have an Yukawa potential with some screening length, and then ask the question, at what point there will be a bound state just forming? And that is Mott's famous argument. It leads to some nice numbers. I will not go into the detail. So the end result is the following. In real systems with long range Coulomb interaction, what you find is you start from a metal, you increase the lattice parameter. At a stage, due to this positive feedback, there will be a first order transition. And the charge gap will jump from zero to a finite value. This is a Mott insulator. Now, in condensed matter physics, in order to reduce complications, we often replace a real system by system described by a Hubbard model with on-site U. It works very well in the Mott insulating, extreme Mott insulating case and into the metallic state, but it of course doesn't work well in the real transition point. Experimentally, no Mott insulator transition is a second order transition. Whereas a Hubbard model will say it's a second order transition. And there are, of course, in helium-3, there may be some connection to what's going on here, but in real electronic system, this is more real than this. So the statement is, in this axis, graphene is here and silicene is somewhere here. So how do I substantiate it further? In fact, this question was asked by Sandro Sorella and Rio Tosati at Trieste many years ago. They took honeycomb lattice, half-filled band, described by Hubbard model, and they did very detailed numerics and found out that when the Coulomb correlation U over Hopping matrix element reaches around 4, there is a transition from metallic semi-metallic state to insulator. And recently, there has been improvement of those results. It happens around 4.1. Now, what about silicene? Fortunately for me, some very interesting calculations are available thanks to this group. They have, using some RPA and going beyond the LDA calculation, estimated for me the U over T and the short-range Coulomb repulsion, which happens after some screening. Now, if you take this, put this, all these things together, immediately it puts silicene into the Mott insulating side. And this group, because they misinterpreted Mott's argument, they got a wrong result, in my opinion. If you follow Mott's argument carefully and use their estimates of U and V, which is very important, you find that silicene actually is sitting on this side in this phase diagram. So silicene is here and the graphene is here. Okay. So this is my basic theoretical observation. Without doing much calculations, I'm able to get it. Now let me look at that. So this is the parameter you get. T is about 1 electron volt. You remember in graphene, it's about 3 electron volt. So it's considerably reduced. U, in the case of graphene, is about 9. Now, in silicene, it is reduced, but not reduced 3 times. So that ratio seems to be important and makes it in a Mott insulator. And I can estimate the Mott-Hubbard gap from the photo emission, which agrees with these numbers. And then what you find is a Mott insulator on a honeycomb lattice whose spin dynamics is determined by a J, which is unusually large. when we talk about quantum magnetism, if you talk to friends working in pyrochlore and so on, they will talk about 10 millielectron volt. In cuprate, maybe we have 150 millielectron volt. Here you have nearly 1 electron volt. So this is something, you know, in a SP system, if the discussion that we have seen is true, you have an opportunity to have an extremely large J. Now, since we are close to Mach transition point, there may be 4 and 6 spin term. So this is a beautiful playground for spin liquid physics, and it needs to be investigated. Yes.
Why not some ordering in the L states? For example, to graphene.
Sure. Exactly. So if you have the 4 and 6 spin terms are small, there will be antiferromagnetic order. Very simple standard. So far, no experiment has been done. Of course, it's very difficult to see local probe and see antiferromagnetic order. You need to do spin-dependent tunneling, which is not very sophisticated. And this one layer, so neutron scattering is very different. So the number of measurements available on silicon is very few. So
but
even...
But it might be there.
It might be there, exactly. You know, I'm... I will say why I'm emphasizing on spin liquid. I will come to it. Yeah.
So I was going to just a related question. So you probably just start with both theory, assuming that there is antiferromagnetic ordering. I mean, would you get similar results?
Exactly. In fact, the quantum chemist Sheka from Moscow, she has been actually challenging condensed matter physics community, saying that silicon should not be stable. She does Hartree-Fock calculation, and she finds strong antiferromagnetic order, which is consistent with all these arguments. So now, if you can take this Mott insulator and then add carriers or remove carriers, you will essentially get some TJ model with this. So this is the so in my opinion, a good starting point to describe the physics of silicon is not free electron theory like in graphene. It needs to have, in a fundamental way, a J, which is large, and also because it comes from a Mott insulator, this projective constraint that if you have an electron doping, you cannot have zero occupancy, or if you have a hole doping, and so on. You know, this famous local constraint for hole or electron doping. So this is a starting point.
The J is about 1 eV here.
Yeah, this is the, you know, embarrassingly large. It's of the order of 1. So telling that it's close to Mott transition rather than extreme Mott localization. So interestingly, you know, there exist a body of studies on honeycomb lattice. In fact, it was started by Choi and McKinnon, which I did not know when I wrote this paper, pointing out some possible contribution to superconductivity from resonating valence bond phenomena. Because still, in my opinion, MgP2 is still a mysterious material, because it has 40 Kelvin superconductivity. It looks like graphite in terms of its electronic structure, because boron is to the left of carbon in the periodic table. So magnesium donates 2 electrons. So each boron grabs 1 electron and becomes basically carbon. And then it's essentially graphite. So it becomes superconductive with 40 Kelvin. So in 2002, I developed this theory emphasizing electron correlation, and then the good friend Seb Doniak, the student Anna Black Schaefer, developed this theory further, and he found D plus ID superconductivity. And then, so after a long lull, you know, then we confirmed it with the work with Shanai and Pathak using variational Monte Carlo. So this is the story until 2010. Then came at least 4 papers. Denghai and collaborators from Berkeley confirmed this and found out that in addition, that in graphene, if you go to quarter doping, due to some nesting, there is interesting other electronic instability. And Nankishore and Levitov and Chubukov, they again confirmed this D plus ID superconductivity. And then from here, Dimo Obanin and collaborators, Tomale and others, they also studied competing instabilities in the same system for moderate U relevant for graphene. But I'm happy that this work existed, you know, which is like a ready-made result from Gu, Zhaogang, and collaborators, that you take TJ model and on a honeycomb lattice, and they studied using this tensor, Grassmann tensor network, and found very encouraging result supporting D plus ID superconductivity. So like square lattice large U or a TJ model, honeycomb lattice also seems to support superconductivity. I think within this standard, you know, within this kind of theoretical analysis, it definitely supports superconductivity. And with 3C, which is very large, which I will discuss now. So the fundamental difference that arises from square lattice to triangular honeycomb lattice is the symmetry of the order parameter. Both are singular superconductors, but this will be a D plus ID rather than a D wave like in cuprate. Okay, now for the sake of, you know, some people who are not familiar with this, how is electron correlation playing an important role in giving superconductivity? Let's go back to BCS theory. There you have beautiful Fermi liquid as a starting point, like in aluminum, lead. You have sharp Fermi surface, and you have carriers and quasi particles close to the Fermi surface. They undergo attractive scattering because of exchange of phonon. And basically, a very tiny fraction of electrons in phase space, essentially h cross omega d divided by Fermi energy, participate in superconductivity. In other words, the modification of states that takes place in going to a superconducting state is a very tiny modification, a very superficial modification on the Fermi surface. But still, the effect is profound in terms of superconductivity, Meissner effect, Josephson effect, and so on. So this is why it is because of this small ratio. TC is often, you know, very small, like 5 Kelvin, 10 Kelvin, 15 Kelvin, compared to Fermi energy, which is 50,000 Kelvin, because one electron volt is 10,000 Kelvin. So you manage to extract a very tiny number, tiny energy scale, whereas when you come to strongly correlated systems, something else happens. This is the message that, due to what I will describe, that instead of h cross omega d by EF, you have x, which is a doping. So the basic idea is the following, that I told you about Mott insulator. Now, in a Mott insulator, in extreme Mott localization, electrons are sitting idle at home. They don't want to move. But however, in real system, there is a small quantum mechanical leakage. An electron can tunnel to the neighbor, like children, you know, going to neighboring house and getting something. So you can go and then come back with the exchange spin configuration. So and gain in the process an energy minus 4t square over u. Whereas if the spins are parallel or if they're in a triplet state, Pauli will stop it. There is a Pauli blocking. So electron-electron interaction and Pauli principle distinguish a singlet state from a triplet state. That's the beginning of quantum magnetism. So it says that in this strongly correlated system, the pairing that you do in a system with a Fermi surface on Fermi surface is, or in K-space, is essentially done at a local level with an enormous strength. So that was the message from RVB theory. So if you want to go to pairing, go to super exchange rather than virtual exchange of phonons in a metal. So super exchange or kinetic, this is what basically leads to this kind of Hamiltonian. And it says that the electron would like to form singlet bonds and resonate, or sometimes antiferromagnetically order. So the story is this. This is, you know, resonating valence bonds theory in a nutshell, in a caricature, that in strongly correlated Mott insulator like this, super exchange leads to very strong covalent bonding or singlets, and there are empty spaces coming from doping, and there are sometimes unpaired spin. So this whole thing quantum mechanically coherently resonate leads to high temperature superconducting state. Very easily explained in words, but difficult to do theory. So that has been the interesting. And also hiding behind this is topological order, quantum order, and many, many beautiful things, as opposed to a simple Fermi C. OK, this already I have said. And there are now many materials, cuprates, organics, heavy fermions, ruthenate, where electron correlations based mechanism of superconductivity is generally accepted. There is no question about it. While theoretically it may be very difficult to do quantitative analysis, but the fundamental physics and relevant models are very, very clear. So the real question is, does electron correlation play in superconductivity in this broadband system? Now, whatever I'm saying seems to point out that it is indeed true. Now let's look at, as theorist, phase diagram. Now, if you take 2D honeycomb lattice and then look at the phase diagram as a function of U over T and doping, n equal to 1 corresponds to half filling. So you have a beautiful semi-metal, and there is some transition to a Mott insulating state. And this transition will be first order if you have long-range Coulomb interaction. Otherwise, it will be second order. Now, if you look at graphene, nature seems to have given us graphene somewhere here. That is, if you look at the U over T ratio, it is not sufficient to make it a Martin insulator. So if you move from here to here, you can get superconductivity. Now, if you, in the same graph, if you look at where silicon and germanium are, they are somewhere here. And what is remarkable in this two-dimensional system, as we saw through various numerics, is that when you go from this strong coupling doped Martin insulator to a intermediate U semi-metal, the scale of superconducting TC doesn't go down exponentially. It only goes down by a factor of 5 or so. This is, in fact, you can see in numerics that because of two-dimensionality, somehow whatever quantum entanglement or singlet formation that you achieve here continues to be there until larger temperature scale or larger energy scale. So the difference between a doped Martin insulator and a metal with intermediate U in two dimension is only quantitatively different. Qualitatively, they are the same. This is also true in one dimension. In one dimension, in fact, you start it right here. The Martin insulation transition takes place right here. So even a small doping, small U, is adiabatically connected to a large U. Yes.
So do we know at n equals 1, whether or not there's a superconducting phase of the boundary between the Martin insulation? I mean, what is known from numerics, for example?
Okay, that's a very good question. So in fact, it has been a lot of debate in the recent past, in the last 2 years, started by the German group, Muramatsu and company. They said that if you follow this line, there is a spin liquid phase, which is Martin insulating. And then after that, there is an antiferromagnetism. So now the consensus is perhaps the spin liquid state is shrunk to zero. So within this picture, there is no superconductivity. You remain as a semi-metal, and then you become Martin insulating. But if you move away from here, our own work and other work show that there is a lot of superconducting correlation, high temperature superconducting correlation in this region, even for intermediate U. In fact, which is what I will show in the next few slides. So this is also something that I want to point out, that if you look at graphene or silicon, the band theory level, the K and K prime points are here. And as you dope, the Fermi surface evolves, and then you get beautiful nesting here corresponding to quarter filling. And that can lead to antiferromagnetism or some complicated spin order. Any question?
I think at a very small doping, like let's say like 5% of doping, if the U is small, I think the graphene is stable. There is no superconductivity.
So
only when U U larger than U is 3 or 4, then you dope it, then you will find
superconductivity. So yeah, I'm giving a very gross picture. You are right. There may be some for small U, a critical doping. In fact, that will become, I will show it in the next few. Yes.
So when you say like a Mod insulator beyond a transition to intermagnetism, can't you just see that as like a Slater insulator where you have some ordering in this?
Yes. So if, yeah, that, in fact, if you say that there is an antiferromagnetic order, you can do Hartree-Fock like theory and then put all the gap on as a Slater gap.
Right.
But there are other, you know, properties which distinguish it from a standard Slater. So this, you know, goes to this debate between Slater insulator and Martin insulator. So the, in fact, one way to is just to frustrate this system and then kill long-range magnetic order and make it a spin liquid by putting additional hopping. And then you still have a Martin insulator.
But that's hard to do in practice.
In practice, yeah, sure. But you are right, you know, ideally, you know, once you have an antiferromagnetic order, you can ride on Hartree-Fock theory and say that it's a Slater insulator. Yes.
But numerics in this case sort of agrees with the Hartree-Fock picture.
Not in detail.
I mean,
in terms of spectrum and so on, there will be fundamental differences. We can discuss it, yeah.
What is known about the hopping beyond nearest neighbor?
In this...
In Sicilian and in Germany? You were talking about some bands.
Oh, in silicon and germanium, you can in fact estimate they're very small.
Very small.
Very small. They're not significant. Like exactly like in graphene, they are not significantly large. So I will describe briefly the work that, you know, Vijay Shanai, Pathak, and myself did So basically, you take a Hubbard model on a honeycomb lattice and write down a variational wave function, a BCS wave function containing d plus id order parameter. So there is an order parameter, which is a variational parameter. And then you do soft Goodsuller projection, that is a g which is less than 1, which discourages double occupancy. And then minimize the Hamiltonian with respect to this parameter g and delta, the BCS order parameter. You do, these guys are experts on this, state of the art, Vijay and Pathak, his student Pathak, then student. You get a superconducting order parameter, which builds up and then peaks around 0.2 doping. And for an u over t, which is 2.4, which is below the critical value. So you have an intermediate u, but still you have substantial order parameter. Now the question is it possible to get some number about the actual superconducting gap? It is possible. That is, you go to the pair correlation function and then measure what is called ODLRO, and then you will see some oscillation of the pair order parameter as a function of distance. So this basically defines your coherence length, which you can extract, and then go to weak coupling theory. And what we found in our work was that if you use weak coupling theory, the Fermi velocity for graphene and the xi that we get from our numerics, you get a TC which is of the order of 200 Kelvin. So this is why we were excited that even graphene, in spite of its intermediate correlation, because it is two-dimensional, could support a costless serverless TC which is as large as 200 Kelvin. Unfortunately, to reach this high doping, it has been extremely difficult with the purity that we require. People have been able to hang around here, and that too with a lot of disorder. There are some recent claims of going to this doping here through what is called polyelectrolyte doping, but that apparently comes with a lot of disorder. So things are not in good shape. So one day, if people can dope it to this level, there is a distinct possibility that the TC may be very large. Okay, now let me come to now speculation. So I try to argue that the model for silicene is that of a TJ model. So instead of the T is about 1 electron volt and J is about 1 electron volt. So if you take TJ for cuprates, this is 4 times TJ for silicene, or the other way. Yeah. So from this you go to this. So do we have a fourfold advantage? That is, do I multiply TC by 40 and declare that TC will be 360 degree Kelvin? Of course, it can't be true because there are many differences, competing orders, and so on. So, but the fact is, if you take the simplistic model, the irreducible minimum model, and then assume that there are no competing orders, about which I'll talk soon, this seems to be a potential playground for very high temperature superconductivity. So this is the message that you have a very distinct possibility. I have not done anything very sophisticated. I started from the quantum chemistry of silicene and pointed out that there is a strong band narrowing. Then I took model parameters from theoretical calculation for U and V and then put it into Mott's argument. And I find that it should be on the Mott insulating side. And then just because the T that I have is very large, and you know, in cuprate it's about 0.2 electron volt. In organics, it's about 0.02 electron volt. Here it's extremely large. So because it's very large, you get an embarrassingly large J. So if you take it to be true, you could have at least twofold advantage. That means if TC could go up to 200 degree Kelvin, that would be wonderful. Now let me conclude. So as I said, there are lots of structural transitions. I have also tried to model it by introducing some pseudo spin variables corresponding to displacements, and you can do some simple RVB mean field theory, and you get lots of interesting things. I will not go into the detail. So let me conclude with this phase diagram, which is schematic. So my statement is silicene is a Mott insulator, so at zero doping. And now the question is it a quantum antiferromagnet? Most likely it's a long range order, but however, because of this structural order that I was talking about, it can go into valence bond ordered state. I will not go into the details of that. There is a very interesting possibility. So you have a structural reconstruction and possibility of valence bond order. And then after some doping, the holes delocalize very efficiently because the hopping matrix element is large. And then based on theory, you can go into the D plus ID superconductivity. And there should be pseudo gap phase. Now, a novel feature of this material should be this at quarter filling, at three quarter filling, because of the nesting. You know, in cuprate, if you take a very simple square lattice, the nesting is at exactly at half filling. So then, you know, that's connected with antiferromagnetism. Here, because of the underlying geometry, the nesting is at a different point. So people have talked about some spiral spin density wave, and then
it has to be spiral speed. That's the way it cannot be
antiferromagnetic. It cannot be simple antiferromagnetic. For example, Tao Li from Rinman University has done very nice analysis and points out that this will have some spin wave which has some chirality also, exactly, involving some handedness of four sublattices and so on. So it would be very nice to. So hiding behind, you know, who would have thought that silicon, if you a layer of silicon could have all these possibilities. Now, if you go a little deep into the quantum chemistry with the help of experiments, all this idea seems to be possible. So germanium, which is the next one, it's in terms of numbers, it's very similar. People have done band structure calculations. The bandwidth is slightly smaller, not very significant. So in my opinion, it should not be very different from silicene. But the point that Anton asked about spin orbit coupling, once I escape a Mott insulating state and come here, spin orbit coupling should play a very interesting role. And I do not know within this picture. So that means you'll have to start with the TJ model with the projective constraint and add spin orbit coupling. There could be interesting physics hiding there. So I think it's a very beautiful system. It needs to be explored further. Thank you very much.
You know, in your model calculation, we know pretty well what is a critical U, right, for the model transition.
Mm-hmm.
And so try to compare with the number you look at. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, this is a Monte Carlo calculation.
Exactly. That is assuming no screening, assuming perfect screening.
Oh, there's a
that's so it's a very important point.
So here there is a 3.8 ISD.
So the when you what you find is in these systems the screening is not perfect. You can estimate the V over T is half of U.
Oh, I see.
Now it is this finite value of V which makes it a first order transition.
I see.
So when one looks at carefully, it enables Mott transition in this honeycomb lattice little sooner than expected, that V contributes to U in some effective way. That's why I have.
Oh, I see. So if you don't count V, then U over T, right, at transition point looks like.
Exactly. It's very close to that.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Already it's very close to that.
Okay.
Now, this pushes it further.
Okay.
Exactly. That's all.
So you said that V is the next nearest neighbor repulsion.
Exactly, nearest neighbor repulsion.
You're saying that finite V already makes the transition first order?
Correct, exactly.
Is that?
So the way to
see.
Numerically, you can
maybe
see.
Long range Coulomb, I can see, but.
Yeah,
so, yeah, the it's like modeling energy. You know, the see, finally, how do I get the first order transition? That is, I create a situation in which I have doublons and holons in the language of Mott transition. So they get some attractive Madelung energy. And if you have sufficient amount of that, that will already lead to first order transition. Yeah, your true long range order is not absolutely necessary. We can discuss about it. A true long range interaction is not absolutely necessary.
I have a question about the material. So in the silicon material, experiment made it, it's just a single layer, or it's kind of like a puppet. It's a layered material with
okay.
Different layers and couples.
So far, through STM, you can very clearly see large area where it's a single layer, and there are regions where it is double layer.
I see.
So,
but in a single layer or double layer, how do you define TC? Because in one of your slides, claim TC like 30 to 40 Kelvin.
Exactly. So you do an STM measurement, as a function of temperature. So
you
do.
It's not really you measure the
No. Yeah. Thanks for pointing out. Unlike graphene, where right from the beginning, once you made graphene, you can make 4-terminal measurements and you can make devices. Here, apparently, it's extremely hard. So not even transport measurements have been made. The only measurements that are available are STM and angular solid photo emission, nothing else. So it's challenging experimentally to have a stable silicon and put leads and so on.
And also in a phase diagram, when close to doping with zero,
yeah,
you expect a kind of new phase. So how the new phase competing with this reconstruction of the...
I have no quantitative idea. I mean, to me, ideally, in the absence of this SP3 mixing, it's more slightly nil order. But somehow this, when you look at the details of this SP3 mixing.
So kind of a break the lattice, like a
C3. Exactly. So it brings atoms together and encourages singlet bonds localization. That's why I have put it as surface structural deconstruction. But you know, I mean, my message is that the starting point for silicene is not a simple band theory. You are sitting in a Mott insulating state, close to the Mott transition. So you cannot ignore Coulomb correlations. At least the 5 experiments that I have looked at, which are the total experiment, every one of them can be explained using electron correlation effect. You can't easily explain it with simple band theory. And more experiments need to be done.
So how do you always estimate the band structure calculation?
OK, so people start like this. If you look at the atomic U, as given by atomic physicists, that's very large, about 13 electron volt for carbon. Then quantum chemists have used methods like PPP Hamiltonian to compare the spectra of benzene with observed spectra. And they have essentially Hubbard model with U and V, and they extract the parameters.
I see. So atomic.
Exactly. So at the level of P-pi bonded molecule, it's very well known. Then condensed matter colleagues have some method, which I don't understand, going beyond LDA using some on top of that RP, and then they estimate U in a very careful way. And that's also large. So I have no clear. So U is, you know, you play with it, you know.
Yeah, usually, I don't know how to compute the U. Usually just say my favorite U is a 5, thanks for the 5.
My favorite U is also 5. So, here, 5 is good for me. So, you know, for example, in the case of cuprate, there are spectroscopic probes that if you really selectively excite some D level,
yeah.
And then Shavatsky is very famous for his work on extracting U from there.
Okay.
Even in the case of graphene, things have not got sophisticated to that level. Basically, you rely on quantum chemistry and extract some U. Thank you.